Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. A true recounting of the high-profile Oregon murder case that led to Carly's Law. Part memoir, part investigative journalism, this is the story Ann Rule called a must-read. Reminiscent of Capote's In Cold Blood, the book has been written in the tradition of new journalism. The writer's proximity to the people involved make for unrelenting storytelling. As Carly's abuse escalates, the investigations unravel at a rapid-fire pace. The book that we're featuring this evening is Carly Sheehan, True Crime of Carly's Law, with my special guest journalist and author Karen Spears Zacharias. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Karen Spears Zacharias.
Thank you, Dan. It's always great to be with listeners around the globe.
Thank you. And like I mentioned, this is a story that many stories affect me, but this one I think is unparalleled in terms of just heart-wrenching, incredible story. And I want to just congratulate you on the writing. You just bring this incredible story to life.
Thank you.
Let's get right into this. Oh, you're welcome. Let's get right into your, as we talked about in the introduction, your proximity to this case. Tell us how you know Sarah, and tell us about your relationship with Sarah and her parents, and how you came to get to know her, and how you got to know Carly Sheehan.
So Sarah was Carly's mom, but I had met Sarah years before when she herself was 13, 14 years old, and I have a degree in education, and I was doing some substitute teaching in a small rural Oregon town called Helix. Sarah was a student there, and she was in a program for in-school suspension, basically. And my husband is an educator as well, and over the years, we had invited troubled kids into our home and, you know, just formed relationships in a mentoring way. Sarah is hard to miss in a crowd, and in a small classroom, even more hard to miss. Not that she's loud or boisterous or any of that. She's very quiet, very soft-spoken, but extremely beautiful. And she is biracial and was living in a community that had like a 4% minority rate. So right off the bat, she was noticeable. But she was also charismatic and engaging and sweet. She just had a very sweet kind of vulnerability to her. So that anybody, and there were plenty of people, not just me, there were plenty of people in the community in which Sarah lived and I lived that surrounded her and encouraged her in a mentoring way. So that's where I first met Sarah. And we developed that kind of mentoring friendship. We had four kids of our own, my husband and I. There were kids in and out of our home all the time. Sarah just became one of those kids who was in and out of our homes. We didn't know when I first met her, but we attended church with Sarah's parents, Jean and Carol Brill. Sarah, I learned over a course of time that Sarah had been adopted. She was adopted as a baby. She was the oldest of Jean and Carol's kids. They went on to have two children of their own, not through adoption, but through natural process. And so I knew Sarah's brother. I knew of her sister. I didn't know her sister that well. I believe her brother had been a student of my husband's. But we all went to the same church. And we didn't know that initially, but we learned that over time. Sarah's mother worked at the junior high, so I had had some encounters with her. Sarah's father was in the medical business. So I knew of him, but I didn't know him that well. Sarah would come in and out of our home and developed a friendship that way, just that mentoring. She felt like a kind of like a, I had three daughters of my own, so kind of like a fourth daughter to me. And I regarded her that way. When Sarah graduated from high school, she was a fabulous runner and very well-read student, but not necessarily because of her own discipline issues, not a high-achieving student. But she had earned a scholarship to, I believe it was Michigan, but her parents didn't want her to go. So she ended up going to the local community college there in Pendleton, Oregon, called Blue Mountain Community College. And during that first year at Blue Mountain Community College, Sarah showed up at our house one evening, told me that she was pregnant, and asked if my husband and I would be willing to adopt that child. I was quite taken back by that, of course. My youngest was 10 years old. My husband was all on board. My husband would have adopted 30 children if I just stay home and take care of them, right? He is great with kids. And I love kids as well. We had four of them. And like I said, they were in and out of our home. But the notion of adopting a baby was daunting to me because my youngest was 10 and I had gone through that stage with my children. So I wasn't quite as eager about it as my husband was. But of course, I was willing to help out anyway, even if that meant. But as I told Sarah at the time, you know, sure, we're willing to do this with a few caveats. If we adopt this child, we want you involved in this child's life. We want our relationship with you to continue. But lastly, the one qualifier for us was that if we were going to raise Jean and Carol's grandchild in that small community, we wanted Jean and Carol Brill's permission to do that, or blessing. Because I, you know, I knew how I would feel as a mother if this were my daughter. So I put that requirement, we put that requirement in place, and Sarah was annoyed by that. She did not understand why in the world we would need Jean and Carol's permission. But when she asked her parents about it, of course they were not supportive of that in any way, because it would be emotionally difficult for them, I'm sure. So, oddly enough, it seemed odd to me at the time, Sarah went off to Tacoma, Washington, to a home for unwed mothers. And that just seemed to me to be a pretty archaic approach to, you know, a problem that's existed since humankind came around. So teenage pregnancy at that time, this was the late 90s. At that time, I mean, Sarah was 19 years old, so it wasn't like you're dealing with a 14-year-old. At that time, she was 19. She was in college. I saw no reason at all for her to go to a home for unwed mothers. I was not involved in that decision. I don't know how it came about. But once I found out that's where she was, I made several trips up to the home myself and visit with Sarah. It just seemed a very depressing place to be. Sarah seemed completely out of sorts there. I didn't know if it had been her decision to go there or her parents' decision that she go there. It seemed to fill her with shame, and I was loath about the whole thing. You know, we explained to Sarah that we could not adopt her baby because we couldn't live in the town with her parents, knowing all of that. So we let that go and let her kind of work through some of that with her parents. But eventually, we were involved in introducing her to the family that did adopt that first child.
Yeah, you talk about this couple, Chuck and Missy McDonald, and you talk about how once this child was adopted, and you said you thought you knew Sarah quite well, and you admired her very much, but what did you note from her behavior with her child and this adopted couple?
Well, so this adopted couple was a friend of a friend, somebody I knew through Bible study, actually. A nurse had come to me and said that she had a friend in Portland, and they had a similar family to ours, lots of older kids. They had been trying to have another child and had not been able to. So they had been wanting to adopt. So I didn't know the couple that well, but I trusted my girlfriend who recommended them. And I went to Sarah and said, you know, I know about this couple. Would you like to meet them? And I made the arrangements for her to meet with this mother. And this happened in a small town on the coast where my sister lives in Washington State. So we all met there, and they hit it off right off the bat. So it was an interesting moment for me because it was like I was grieving a baby that I wasn't going to have, but I was happy for Sarah because I could tell that she connected with this mom, so that was great. But what happened then is Sarah went into labor, and she called me. She was in Tacoma. I was in Pendleton. She called and asked me to come up, and I said, is your mom there? And she said, yes. And I said, Sarah, I'm not coming up. If your mom is there and Missy is there, I don't belong there, right? And Sarah was very upset that I would not come up. But I just felt, I was just trying to be respectful of every, you know, her mom's feelings and Missy's feelings. I didn't feel like I had a place there, other than, you know, to be that emotional connection for Sarah. That upset Sarah that I didn't come up. A few days, so I didn't see her interaction with the baby to begin with. A few days later, I got a phone call from Missy. Sarah was getting ready to check in the hospital, and she didn't want to let the baby go. And I was of two minds on that, right? Like, I felt like Sarah was completely capable at age 19 of taking care of a baby on her own if that's what she chose to do. I knew that she would do it. I felt at that point that she would do a good job. Missy was distraught in that way that adoptive moms can get sometimes. In those situations, it was so full of emotion. And so I just said to Missy, listen, why don't you invite Sarah home? Because, I mean, you know, Sarah had been living with us through part of our, not at that time, but we had opened the door and said to her, after the baby's born, why don't you come live with us? You can go to college here. You can live with us. Because the situation between Sarah and her mom had deteriorated badly through this pregnancy. And so we had opened that door, but Sarah wasn't ready to let go of the baby. And, I mean, I didn't care whether she let go of the baby or not. I didn't have a vested interest at that point other than I wanted it all to be Sarah's choice. Let her make the decision because she was the one that would have to live with the consequences of it. And so Missy and Chuck invited Sarah to their home. And Sarah went home with them for about 2 weeks, long enough for the baby shower to happen. And that is where I first encountered Sarah with the baby. And she was very tender. She seemed very attentive, actually, very concerned. But she, like any girl in that situation, was confused about what she really wanted. And I think she felt a lot of pressure from Missy and Chuck on what to do. Eventually, she did leave their home and she came to live with us and she left the baby with them.
Now tell us about what happens with Missy, and you are continuing contact with Missy as well regarding Sarah. And Missy tells you some things that are a surprise to you about her. So tell us what those things are and how you end your relationship with Missy. Who do you side with?
Well, so there was a natural drawing away of Missy between Sarah and her. I don't think that surprised me at all. I don't mean this in a crass way at all. They are great. Missy and Chuck are great people, and they have a beautiful, loving family. But there comes that point where the mom who's given up the child can't help but feel marginalized or neglected. Missy had been very attentive to Sarah up until she adopted the baby. Then, of course, all of the focus goes on that child. My focus from the get-go had always been on Sarah and less on this baby that I was not adopting. But apparently there had been an exchange of uncomfortable words between Sarah and Missy. A sense where Missy felt like she had given Sarah opportunity to build a relationship with this infant and Sarah didn't take advantage of it. Or, there came a point where Missy felt like she needed to cut off contact with Sarah for the health of her own family. And I was probably I was definitely very protective of Sarah at that point.
Sure.
I had had a teen pregnancy myself, at age 17 and had had an abortion. And Sarah knew that. And so it was easy for me to relate to the emotional conflict that Sarah found herself in, because I had found myself in similar conflict. So I was extremely protective of Sarah and annoyed, I think, at Missy's comments. And I felt a little bit like Sarah had been used, and I didn't like that. So there came a point where I cut off, where we mutually, I think, came to, I think Missy had written me a letter and kind of cut things off. Mm-hmm. I think there had been an exchange of letters back and forth, and so that was fine. Sarah continued to live with us for about a year while she was attending the local community college. She dated off and on during that time. We had a nurturing, loving relationship. Absolutely loved Sarah, and she knew that I did. And so did my kids. Our whole family did. She was part of our Christmas card that year. We both loved reading and writing, so we shared that. And she was just always so much fun. But I was troubled by her relationship with men. She had started dating someone in town that I felt like the reason she was dating him was for selfish reasons, for materialistic reasons. Sarah was fun, and she loved to party. And at that time, party to me just meant, you know, hanging out. I was unaware of any drug use or alcohol use. We didn't drink in our home. We had taken in other kids prior, and so the rule at the house had always been, you know, no drinking, no drugs. If Sarah was using anything or abusing anything at that point, I was completely unaware of it. But I did feel like she would enter relationships with men, young men, and lead them on and use them. And I saw this as a pattern throughout that year, and it concerned me greatly.
Now tell us about how things seem to change in your eyes and a lot of people's eyes when she meets this David Sheehan. And you could tell us a little bit about David Sheehan and how they met before we talk about what happened soon after in their relationship.
Yeah. So we had throughout the year encouraged Sarah to go off to university. And we, both my husband and I, are graduates of Oregon State University in Corvallis, which was about a 6.5-hour drive from Pendleton, where we were living. Throughout that year that she lived with us, we just encouraged Sarah to go away to Corvallis, to go to Oregon State. She was a bright girl. She could have studied anything and done really well. We encouraged her to go to OSU. So she did. She went down to OSU. Now, I was working as a reporter and journalist, had four kids, teenagers of my own at that time, was working on some other book projects as well. So it was a very busy time of life for us. But one day we get this phone call from Sarah saying she had somebody she wanted to bring by to meet us. And it was a fellow by the name of David Sheehan, and he was from Ireland. And my husband, who had grown up in Ecuador, is a big soccer fan, and so was David Sheehan. So when Sarah brought David to the house, we adored him from the get-go. Oh my gosh, I couldn't have been more happy for Sarah that this was a guy that she met, she was marrying, and they were moving to Ireland. And I was ecstatic because I felt that David was funny and kind and absolutely adored Sarah. And I felt like that emptiness that she felt in her soul, having been adopted and then adopting out a baby, I felt like David would bring healing to that. And she seemed genuinely happy at the time. They both did. They did go and live in Ireland for a while. I can't remember. I think it was about 18 months. They came back to Corvallis, and Sarah got pregnant with Carly Sheehan. I first met Carly right around her christening day. I think she was about 6 weeks old when I first could get away to get down to Corvallis to see Carly. My daughter was with me. And when they knew we were coming, when we arrived, only David was there with this infant daughter, and Sarah had gone out golfing. And I thought that was strange that Sarah would not be there, knowing, I mean, she loved my daughters and she loved me. And I just thought, well, this is just odd. And we spent the afternoon with David and with Carly. She was wonderful and sweet and all of those things. We had a great visit. And during that time period, I had a book published. So we were very, very busy. We ended up moving that year, all of those things. Somewhere during that year, about when Carly was a year old, Sarah called me and in the new town we were living in, Hermiston, and she said that she wanted to talk to me. It was a very tumultuous time in my life. I was working on a memoir about my father's death in Vietnam, and I was literally in the throes of quitting my job and going to Vietnam. Like, I was leaving that next week for Vietnam, and this was during the time period of the war in Iraq. And so it was very chaotic for a news journalist like I was. Sarah called, and we were just, I just had an upsetting phone call at work, and then I had this call from Sarah, so I know exactly where I was. I pulled over and to talk to Sarah, and she told me that she was leaving David. And, you know, probably because of where I was emotionally myself, working on the memoir about my father's death, and as much as anything, I just blew up at Sarah. I was like, what do you mean you're leaving David? Like, David's like the best thing that's ever happened in your life. Why would you be leaving him? And she said, I'm just bored. I'm not happy. And I was really, like, I lost it. My youngest daughter was home. My other three kids had gone off to college at that time. It was just, I think a combustion of a lot of bad karma at that point. I had never, ever yelled at Sarah before. I had never, I mean, she did things like anybody when you're living together, there'd be things that agitate you, but I'd never been extremely upset with her over anything. But that day, over Carly, I just had this sinking, sick feeling Not that any harm would come to Carly, but that it would be the worst decision ever for her to leave David and for her to be the parent of Carly. Because I think I knew in that moment that, and I'm probably had a sense of that throughout the years, that Sarah's big struggle had always been that Sarah put Sarah first. And so I just told her that she couldn't do this, that Carly needed her dad. We just had a big fight. That's just what it boiled down to. I left for Vietnam the next week. That was, I can't, so that would have been in February, I think of 2003 or four. Three. And I did not see Sarah again for years. Did not even speak to her again for years.
What you write in the book is that you actually added, like again, in your anger, you said, listen, you are not going to be always able to trade off on your looks. And someday you're going to be old and ugly. And what are you going to do? And I guess that was part of the insult, and you didn't speak to her again. It was till 2007 when you say you made a trip with your husband, Tim, to Bend, Oregon, March 2007, correct, to visit two of your four children, Stephen and Connie.
Right.
And you found that day's newspaper, and you saw Sarah's photo holding up a burnt dollar bill. It didn't have her name there, but you all recognized Sarah's photo. So tell us what happened that eventful day from then on.
So I actually had not seen the photo. My son saw it. Stephen had seen it, and he held up the newspaper to me that morning over breakfast and said, Mom, isn't this Sarah? And I took one look at it, and I knew it was, and I said, yes. What does the article say? And he said, doesn't say anything about her. It just is about a bunch of girls out on the town and some of their money got caught in a fire pit. And I said, so is Sarah living here in Bend, Oregon? Because my daughter just moved there and my son was already living there. And of course, because I had not been in contact with Sarah, nobody had been in contact with Sarah. And yes, I had been very blunt with Sarah about trading off on her looks because I knew that that was a pattern when she lived with us and it had continued to be a pattern. And so I said, is she living here? And nobody knew. I didn't have a phone number for her. By this time, we're all using cell phones and it's not like you could go look somebody up in the yellow, you know, white pages. So I prayed that morning in the shower, God, you know, if Sarah's here, let me run into her, which is just kind of a ridiculous prayer on some level, but it's just, you know, the way I operate my life sometimes. And so that afternoon we were out for a walk in Bend, Oregon. And literally two blocks from my daughter's house, there is this girl in these high heels, which is an unusual sight in Bend, Oregon. This was kind of it's an outdoors area. So most people have on sneakers or sandals. So to see a woman in high heels in Bend, Oregon was incongruent. So I noticed her high heels before I noticed her, and I walked up, and it was my daughter saw her first, and she goes, Mom, it's Sarah. And I'm like, you're kidding. No, it was her, and we ran into each other. She was there with a realtor looking at this house around the corner from my daughter's house. And we hugged, and she was very effusive and said to the realtor, excuse me, but this is my family, because that's how she considered us. And I you know, we made plans to meet at my daughter's house when she was done with her business. She came up not very long afterwards. We were sitting around talking, and my husband said that he could tell something was wrong right away. But I didn't. I couldn't. You know, I was just so happy to see her and to kind of restore that brokenness that had happened between us. Because I'm not the kind of person that goes for years without speaking to my friends. I stay in touch with lots of people. And so I was just chatting. She was telling me what she was doing. We talked about all the kids and about I'd had, you know, this memoir about my dad published. And so at you know, in my head, I'm figuring out how old Carly is, and I'm thinking, okay, she would be, you know, at this point, she would be 5, so she would be in school. So I made the assumption that Carly was living with David and going to school in Corvallis, and so I said to Sarah something along that line, is Carly with her dad? And the whole, like, this silence just fell over the room. Like, it was, I can still just, you know, it's so real to me still, that kind of silence. I've only encountered one other time, and that was when my dad died. And Sarah said, she started twisting her hair, which I knew was a nervous tick of hers. And she said, Carly is dead, and I'm having a very hard day, so I don't want to talk about it. Wow. You know, I just looked at Tim, and he looked at me. And the thing is, I had been traveling around the country with a photographer from New York. We were interviewing a lot of Gold Star families at that time. These are women and children who had lost loved ones in Iraq and Afghanistan by 2007. And I just come off that gig. So when a Gold Star wife says to me she can't talk, I know to respect that. So I allowed Sarah that same respect, that whatever happened, she did not want to talk about right then, and that was okay. I would give her that space. I had no idea what had happened. I didn't know if Carly had died of a brain tumor or, you know, childhood leukemia, or had been killed in a car wreck. I had no idea. We made plans to go out to dinner that night. We went out to dinner, we had a good time, and everything was just restorative, really. It was just like it had always been. She was part of our family and we loved her. But that night after dinner, I said to, you know, my daughter and then to my husband, whatever has happened to Carly, she feels guilty about it. And I, you know, it was a different kind of guilt that you, or sense that you have, maybe through my years of reporting, I could tell the difference between something that happened where a parent wasn't responsible versus where a parent felt that they were responsible. And I could tell that Sarah felt that responsibility. The next morning she called me. We made plans to get together again. I apologized to her and told her I was sorry I had not been there with her through that time of losing Carly. I felt horrible about that. We get in the car. My husband and I are driving home. It's a long drive. We didn't have iPhones at that point. But I said to my husband, whatever happened to Carly, I don't know, but Sarah feels bad about this. It's like she thinks it's her fault. And in my mind, what I'm thinking is that she was been on her phone or she had been in some sort of car wreck, and that had caused Carly's death. And my husband said, that's not what happened. And I said, well, how do you know what happened? He said, because Stephen looked it up last night. And I said, well, what happened? And he said, you don't want to know. And I said, Tim, you have to tell me what happened. I'm a journalist. As soon as I get home, I'm going to Google this myself.
Right.
So tell me what happened. And he just really was reluctant. It took him a few minutes, and he said, Carly's boyfriend tortured and murdered Carly. Or Sarah's boyfriend tortured and murdered Carly. I literally couldn't breathe. When he told me, I was physically ill at that moment. I just felt like all the air had been sucked out of me. I couldn't get my mind around it. I was shocked, absolutely shocked by it. And then we had that 4.5-hour drive home. I did not Google it. I didn't Google it for months, but what I did do was I called David right away, because all I could think, this murder had happened in 2005. Well, 2005 was the year the memoir of my dad came out, and I had only been home 6 weeks out of that whole year because I was traveling and speaking so much about war and its impact on children and families. So I hadn't seen the news, and my kids had seen it, but they hadn't put it together. Like, they had seen, you know, that a child had been killed, but, you know, they just had not put it all together. And so I called David first thing and said, I want to come see you. I literally got in the car and drove down there the next day. And David and I met for coffee, and I told him then, I will write the story if you give your blessing. And he did. And I wrote the story of what happened to Carly. It's one of the hardest things. I mean, I thought writing about the story of my dad's death in Vietnam would be the hardest story I would ever write in my life. But Carly topped it.
Absolutely. Let's use it as an opportunity just to stop for a second, Karen, to talk about ZipRecruiter. Hiring? Every business needs great people and a better way to find them. Something better than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter knew there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't stop there. They even spotlight the strongest application you receive so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there. ZipRecruiter is how you find them. Businesses of all sizes trust ZipRecruiter for their hiring needs. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, you had this heart-wrenching conversation with David. You hadn't even heard the news. You had missed the trial. You wanted now his permission to write this book. And being a journalist and being so involved in this, and we will talk about it a little bit later. You got an incredible break from somebody unusually. Well, it was an unusual break to get information from a defense attorney. So we'll talk about that when you think it's appropriate, about that information that you gained from that and how unusual that is. So how did you once you knew that there was this murder, and again, you said you didn't even look online, Google anything for a few months, how did you first start to undergo to do this book, the research necessary?
So my through an interview with David, what had happened, you know, just the very basics. When did the when, why, how, what had happened? I had learned that David had literally been Curly's caretaker for the bulk of her life. So a divorce was not a big deal to him. By the time the divorce came around, he was so exhausted with Sarah that he was happy to be shunned of her. Because Sarah, as I would come to learn through my research and my own, you know, memories of her, was a narcissist. And that narcissism can just be exhausting to deal with. She had a gambling habit. She had a lot of problems. But David had been Carly's primary caretaker. So I had not, that's why when I was there just, you know, a few weeks after her birth, David was the one there and Sarah was gone. From infancy, from, as I would learn from the medical records, from even the very first hours after she was born, a nurse made notes in the medical records that Sarah wasn't interested in Carly, that David was the primary caregiver, even at the hospital.
Right.
So, the you know, after talking with David, the first place I went to was the Benton County Courthouse and pulled as many records. I'd been a cop reporter, so I knew how to pull records. I went and pulled all the records I could get through the county clerk, who, when she handed over, you know, when we got to the document stage, she pulled me aside and said, listen, because you know this family, because you know this child, I'm just warning you that when you get to the picture phase of this, you need to be very careful about what you look at because of your own emotional health.
Right.
And so I went, I just did the basic footwork. I did not contact the reporter of the newspaper who had covered this story because I did not want my writing and my research to be tainted by the stories in the paper. I wanted to get my own research. So I started calling all of the parties involved, the police officers who had responded to phone calls, the DHS worker, the daycare provider, the prosecutor in the case, the defense attorney in the case. And I had been a cop reporter, so I already had a pretty good working relationship in the state with Oregon State Police. The lieutenant in Pendleton was a good friend of mine socially because our kids dated. Pendleton's a small town. So we knew each other, and I had good working relationships with both defense and prosecutors in Umatilla County. So it was actually one of the defense attorneys in Umatilla County that had said to me when he knew what I was working on, listen, if anybody needs a reference, have them call me. He was one of the most well-respected defense attorneys in the state. So that's what I did is, you know, I would just go in and introduce myself and say, if you need a reference, here are some people you can call. I did that with the defense attorney in this particular case, and he did call. And the next time I visited with him, he turned over all of his files to me. Everything.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. I was shocked.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that just defense attorneys don't do that sort of thing.
No. No, they don't.
So, of course, I mean, you're talking 6,000 pages of documents
sure.
because the trial was that long and that complicated. There had been 3 DHS state investigations into possible child abuse filed by Carly's daycare provider, who was did all the right things. I often hear from readers about how many people messed up, and there's plenty of reason for readers to think that. But
sure.
I think it's important to note that of all the people involved, the daycare provider did everything within her power to protect Carly. She did all the right things.
She was, I would say, over and beyond the duty, because other people were doing, and in retrospect, after you spoke to them, they were concerned, but this person really took that extra effort. Tell us about those DHS investigations. You say this Delene Zoller was instrumental in getting the ball rolling. And you know, amazingly, when you read about the, not the indifference, but sort of the, that people aren't getting, they're hearing Sarah's side of the story. So
mm-hmm.
tell us about how this investigation prompted by this child care provider, Delene Zoller.
Yeah, so what happened was in August of 2004, David had taken Carly and gone to Ireland, where his parents lived. He was not a U.S. citizen at the time. That needs to be noted. David was in Corvallis working for Hewlett-Packard, you know, the computer company. He was an engineer, and he did not He was here on a work visa, they had tons of Irish people. David wasn't the only one. There were like 200 some they brought in to work on those projects. But David had not become a United States citizen at that point. He is a citizen now, but he wasn't then. And so that comes into play in the story. So David takes Carly, goes to Ireland. They have a wonderful trip. During that trip, Carly's just vibrant and fun and sweet and all of the things that make up who Carly was. When they came back from Ireland, David and Sarah had agreed to a shared custody. At least 80% of the time, David kept Carly anyway because Sarah didn't, she was too busy. She wanted to go out with her girlfriend. She wanted to golf. She wanted to party. So they had this arrangement with, you know, as part of the divorce proceedings that they had agreed to of shared custody. Sarah would have her so many days. David would have her so many days. Most of the time David had her, up until September of 2004. And Sarah met a man by the name of Sean Field. Sean Field was a local Corvallis boy. His dad worked for Hewlett-Packard, had a 30-year career with Hewlett-Packard. And his mom was a stay-at-home mom. Sean had lived on the north side of town in the more upper-class section near the golf course. He came from a well-to-do family. They owned homes in Corvallis and in Central Oregon and in Arizona. Sean had an older brother who died of a heroin overdose several years before. Sarah met Sean at a place where she worked. She worked at a pizza company and bar, and she mostly worked the bar. And they had met, and within 2 weeks of meeting, had moved in together. Now, during this time, Sarah kept her own apartment. Throughout all of this, Sarah kept her own apartment. So it was never a situation where financially she needed to depend upon Sean.
Right.
Sarah had came from an upper middle class family herself, and her parents often paid for things and provided for her. David had helped provide for her, offering even to send her back to college because in David's mind, a well-educated mother makes for a better mom.
Sure.
So there, I can't stress enough, because oftentimes the perception is that child abuse happens to poor women who find themselves financially dependent upon abusive men. That was not this case. And oddly enough, the fact that it wasn't played against the investigation.
Certainly.
Because it didn't fit the stereotype. Within 2 weeks of Carly being home, and now Sarah has, this is mid-September, and she has introduced her daughter to a man she barely knows. He has told her that he's got several master's degrees, that he, you know, works all these different jobs, and yet he never really works. And so with it, so this is mid-October, she's moved in with him. By mid-October, Sarah is writing false diary entries that would later come out in court. And these false diary entries are things where she's accusing David of abuse, using words that she, or stories that she's made up that she's attributing to Carly. It's just, you know, a bizarre thing to have done, that you would write these diary entries accusing your husband of abuse that's never even taken place. But Carly, during this time period, this four-week time period, DeLynn Zoller, her daycare provider, starts noticing changes in Carly's appearance and her demeanor. She comes to daycare, she's more tired than normal, she seems depressed, doesn't want to engage, isn't her light and lively self, she has odd bruising, and her hair seems to be thinning. And Carly had beautiful blonde towhead hair, but it was never like really thick to begin with, but now it's thinning. And so one day, DeLynn is talking to Carly about some scratches that she sees. And Carly says, "My daddy did this." And DeLynn's like, "What?" Like, she knew that David would not be that person to do this kind of thing. And she said, "My daddy hits me. My daddy pulls my hair." And DeLynn, you know, she does the appropriate thing. She contacts DHS, the state offices of abuse. She calls the abuse hotline number, reports it. David and Sarah are ordered to meet with the pediatrician. Now, the thing about it is that Carly's doctor also happened to be Sarah's primary care doctor. So this is, you know, this is a doctor Sarah saw when she was pregnant with Carly. And so she's already got an established relationship with this doctor. It never occurs to the doctor, because here's where the things that came into play, right? Why would a mother lie about those sorts of troublesome signs on her daughter. Why would an educated, beautiful, smart, intelligent woman lie about such things? It just never entered her mind that Sarah would be lying about Carly's welfare. Why would any mother do that? So DHS looks into this early on in October, comes back with a ruling in November, and says that there's it's inconclusive, that they can find no signs of abuse, that maybe, you know, Carly's got some health issues. So the doctor's running all these tests looking for health issues. There is a disorder that children can get where they tear out their own hair. Sarah learns this, and she begins repeating them, saying that Carly is doing this to herself.
Right.
And all the while, the abuse is continuing. All the while. And Carly, I asked the doctor during the course of this investigation, why did Carly never tell anybody what was happening? And she said, children don't tell because they love their mothers. And that just kind of blew me away to think about it. Part of writing Carly's story is to talk about how the court system and the law enforcement system is bringing its own biases to bear, in that we assume that moms are the better caretakers and the least likely to abuse children. And that is just statistically not held up. And in fact, mothers acting alone are more likely to abuse their own children than fathers, than boyfriends. And that just goes against everything all of us have assumed and believed. But
you also talk about
the facts.
You also talk about that bias leads to a neglect of proper normal procedure. When we talk later about, you know, people being questioned apart from each other, and a crucial moment is when you have this Officer Cox. Maybe you can tell us about this incident, because this is important to this investigation, you say, and derailing
right.
it quite a while.
So this becomes the most critical derailment moment for me, and I think for all of us, in that among a whole host of critical derailments. But so one day, Sarah and David had a pattern of making an exchange on Saturdays with Carly at the local Starbucks, kind of a halfway meeting point for the both of them. One day, Sarah contacts David and says, Carly's not feeling well. This is early December now. Carly's not feeling well. So can I bring her to your house today instead of meeting you at Starbucks? David's thinking Carly has a flu, and so David says, sure, you know, fine, bring her by. Sarah shows up with Carly. Carly is completely bald. She has no hair at this point.
Wow.
She has bruise marks all along the side of her head, fingerprint bruise marks. All along her head. She looked, I've got pictures of her, you can find them online. She looked like a chemo patient. When David opens the door and he sees Carly, he's in complete and utter shock. And of course, outrage. And he just says, Sarah, what the hell has happened here? And Sarah said, this is on me. And that is all she said, and she leaves. Well, David's concern immediately turns to Carly. But now he's in a situation where, number one, he's not a U.S. citizen. Number two, he's just had a DHS investigation in which, you know, Carly has told her, or at least, you know, the report from DeLynn is that Carly had told her that her daddy had been abusing her. Now he's got this child that absolutely has been abused. There's no question in his mind that she's been abused. But nobody's seen the exchange take place. So how do you call the cops and tell them what's happened? You don't know for sure exactly what's happened. And the minute you call the cops, they're going to finger you for this. Because Sarah can just say that you've had her. Who's? It's going to be your word against Sarah's at this point.
Right.
David didn't know what to do. And, of course, he didn't want to do anything that would mean them taking Carly away from him that day.
Right.
Because she needed her daddy at that point. Is the catch 22. So what he did do was go to a neighbor's house, a good friend of his, to say, you know, to ask, what should I do? This was a married couple that had been friends with both him and Sarah, who knew Sarah very well. And what he didn't know is that she was having a baby shower that day for a friend of hers. And among that crowd was a teacher. And teachers are mandatory reporters. When those women saw that baby in that condition, that mandatory reporter called the Corvallis police and reported it. Carly didn't let her dad set her down all day long. Even to go to the bathroom was a problem for him. Not Carly. Because she just didn't want to let go of her dad. He finally gets her to bed. 11 o'clock at night, here comes this officer from Corvallis Police Department beating on the door, demanding to see Carly, whom David has just recently gotten to bed. Cox goes in there with a flashlight, pulls the covers back, completely shocks an already traumatized girl, accuses David of this abuse, leaves there and goes to see Sean and Sarah and interviews them together separately, then writes a very cursory report, again pointing fingers at David. Along comes a female cop who has been reading all the headlines about Catholic sex abuse that's being reported in the Portland papers at the time. And David is a devoted Catholic. And this female cop and this DHS worker from that point on start pointing everything at David. And, of course, Sarah leads them to continue to think that.
It's an incredible turn of events. It's also, you say that David suffered some naivety quite a while, too, because instead of what she was doing was subtly accusing him, that he was defending her to a great degree and thinking even that he had no evidence. He was very, like you say, diplomatic. He didn't think that Sean Field, he had no evidence that he was doing anything, and he just really didn't want to believe Sarah could do anything to her own child, did he?
Yeah, he could. He really, David is, he operates from a different perspective. Number one, his biggest fear was he was going to be deported and never see Carly again.
Yeah.
I mean, that undergirded everything he thought about. I'm not a U.S. citizen. I don't know the U.S. court system. I don't know how all this works. Sarah's accusing me of this. I could be deported. I could lose my job. I could lose all contact with Curly. He was terrified of that. I can't stress that enough. Did he make all the right decisions? David would tell you, first of all, like, Curly's dead. Like, there's so many things he would have done differently now. But he didn't know. You know, and it's easy for any of us to go back and judge in hindsight what we do differently to stop the death of a loved one, right? If we could do that. David believed in this system. David believed that if they did their investigation the right way, that they would find the proof. He believed in his heart that Sean was abusing Curly. He interrogated Curly over and over again. Curly would never say that Sean was abusing her. She never said that. And when you ask professionals why children don't tell, well, I mean, this is why the bulk of child abuse takes place for children ages 4 and under, because they can be controlled. A lot of them aren't articulate. They are afraid. We don't know what kind of things Sean said to Curly to keep her quiet. We don't know what threats he made. Did he tell her that he would kill her daddy if she said anything? She never said, and David asked over and over again. That made him second guess everything, because Curly was articulate. She was a bright girl. She had full sentence structure. She could have put it together, but she wouldn't. And he never could quite grasp why, if this man is hurting her, why she's not saying that. But like I said, we don't know the threats that Sean made to Curly that she believed. So David trusted the system in a way that he knows now he should never have trusted. He didn't understand the internal biases. He couldn't. He's such a good guy that he couldn't believe that anybody would actually think he would abuse his own daughter, right? Like, this was his life. So the concept that anybody thought he was guilty of hurting the one thing he lived and breathed for was just so foreign to him. And then, you know, he had been married to Sarah. He loved her. He wanted to believe that she would not put her daughter in a situation to be harmed. It was a very confusing time for him. He didn't appreciate the forces working against him. He had some sense of it through the DHS investigator and through the female cop, Karen, I can't think of her last name right now.
Slaughter.
Oh, odd
Stoddard.
Last name, right? Anyway, so he had some sense of it because Stoddard was so aggressive in her approach to him. But that just, you know, if it were me and someone came at me like that, I would push back. But I'm a U.S. citizen, so I don't live with the fear of being deported.
Let's talk about how in these meetings, in these DHS meetings, because we probably won't have time to go through. There's so much more to this book and to the trial, but let's talk about her culpability. because we can just say that she was never charged with anything, but in your
she
research,
never was.
In all the research you did, you talk about some very, very disturbing things, like the living arrangement. You said, you talked about she always maintained her apartment with her friend, Shelley.
Right.
But at the same time,
right.
she had said in these DH meetings that she had just moved to this apartment with Sean Fields, and from that point, they attributed Carly's strange behavior, pulling out her hair or hitting herself. They said that she hit herself, all self-inflicted wounds.
Right.
But one of the crucial things to gain trust with the doctor, DeSouza, and with everyone, was the promise that she was going to move out. Tell us about this promise and tell us about the reality.
So after the second investigation with DHS, which again was ruled unfounded, right? Like they knew she was being abused, but they couldn't pinpoint who was doing the abuse, or maybe she wasn't being abused. Maybe she was just upset by her mom's new boyfriend, and so she's pulling out her own hair and she's harming herself. The finding itself is unbelievable. When you see the pictures, you're like, well, everybody who works at DHS just is stupid if they think a child could do this to themselves at age 3. So Sarah has lied. Like, that's why I bring up the diary in October. Sarah started lying against David as early as 4 weeks after moving in with Sean. And so she makes some of those diary entries. From that point on, there is this whole pattern of lying. Every step of the way, she lied to protect herself and to protect Sean. She never once lied in favor of protecting Carly, not once. When I went to the prosecutor and asked, you know, the Benton County prosecutor, why did you not charge Sarah? I mean, there's so much evidence that she was complicit in the death of her own daughter. Why in the world did you not charge her with anything, neglect, abuse, anything? And he said that he thought that she had suffered enough. It was in that moment that I already knew that the courts were slanted toward mothers to begin with. But when he said, I thought that Sarah had suffered enough, I knew that he had made that decision in a moment of haste to get the goods on Sean Field, which, by the way, Sarah never really gave up. The goods on Sean Field came from a good investigation post-mortem, you know, not prior. It came later. Sean Field maintained up in the forever that he was not involved in this. There's a time lapse even of when Carly is found dead, and how long had Sarah been home before that 911 call had been placed.
Right, that's right.
So I'm still to this day undecided on whether she contributed physically to the abuse of her own daughter. She certainly contributed in a complicit way to the abuse of her own daughter. She had DHS and said, look, we don't know whether your daughter is being abused or not, but she's clearly, if she's not being abused and she's doing this to herself, then you need to quit being with this boyfriend because it's not healthy for your daughter. And Sarah agreed to that, again, lied to do that. She never quit seeing Sean Field through all of this. She never quit seeing him. And so there was a time period where she quit taking Carly around him for about 2 months. But by Easter of 2005, she was taking Carly around Schoenfield again. And she claims that she had broken up with Schoenfield. And again, you know, initially one of the prosecuting attorneys had wanted me, Joan Demarest, had wanted me to believe that Sean was abusive of Sarah. There's no evidence anywhere that Sean was ever abusive of Sarah. Sarah was not a domestic abuse situation. She had her own apartment. She had her own money. She had parents who were willing to help her. She had friends willing to help her. She had David willing to help her at the drop of a hat. She never was in a situation where she had no other option but to leave Carly with Sean. She never had that. Sarah willingly and at every point over and over again put her daughter in harm's way without regard for Carly's life.
Let's talk about that blatant disregard, the whole thing with the parking lot. It is despicable. It is, it's deplorable. But let's talk about June 2nd. Again, the woman that's not supposed to have her daughter alone with this Sean. She has been through these investigations. She wants to break up with him because she discovers gay porn on his computer. Like you say, she's certainly not a battered woman. He's not in control of her. But tell us about the water bill and the anger and her bar work that evening and when she actually came home after that shift. Tell us all about June 2nd.
So June 2nd, 2005, a few weeks prior, Sarah had come across gay porn on Sean's computer. And it wasn't just a matter of gay porn. She came across emails as well that showed that Sean was having sexual relations with men in Corvallis. One of those happened to be a prominent university employee. And so when she came across that gay porn, she and Sean had a huge fight. I think that Sean, you know, if I had to guess, I would have to say that he was bisexual, but he came from a fundamentalist home. If his parents had thought for a moment that he was bi or gay, his parents would have disinherited him. And not having access to his parents' money was a huge motivating factor for Sean, because as the sole surviving child, he would inherit everything his parents had, and it was sizable. And so he said to Sarah at that point, they had a big blow-up fight, and he said, "You've ruined everything." She took Carly and left and went back to her own apartment and did not have anything to do with him for a couple of weeks. That's where she tells the investigator she literally finally broke up with Sean. But on June 2nd, she's back over at Sean's, and she has to work, and she needs a ride, and he's yelling at her about, you know, the water bill. Apparently, they shared, you know, the bills at his place, too, and he had given her the money. I can't remember exactly how that went. He had given her the money to pay the water bill, and she had not paid it, and they had cut off the water or threatened to cut off the water. And so she'd gone down to the city to pay the bill, and that had not gone well. And there was just a lot of chaos over that water bill. And yet, even in the midst of all that, Sarah had to work a shift that evening. And instead of calling anybody else, she knew that Sean Field was furious at her over that water bill. And yet she left Carly with Sean that night. And she went to work. It was just a stupid waitressing job. It wasn't anything where Sarah needed to work, had to work, was in a situation where she couldn't have said, I'm calling in, I'm not going in tonight because I want to be with my daughter and I'm not about to leave her in your care when you're this angry at me. There was none of that. It was, David's up in Portland, so I'm taking Carly and leaving her with Sean. This man that I have been fighting with for weeks now, she could have left her with Shelly. Shelly would have been happy to take Carly. But no, Sarah went, and Carly is hysterical. She does not want to be left with Sean. She's terrified. She just doesn't want to be alone with him. And Sarah goes off to the pizza place and the bar, and she's only supposed to be gone for like 4 hours. But she doesn't come home till well after midnight. And patrons at the bar that night testified later that he had met Sarah out in the parking lot. She'd given him a blowjob out in the parking lot. Yeah. So she was not only working because she wanted to work, she was working because she was partying. And so she doesn't get home till late, and she doesn't check on Carly when she gets home. The next morning when Carly gets up, she's complaining of a headache. These are the pictures the clerk advised me not to look at, but I did. And in that picture, you see that Carly has a ruptured eyeball. She looks like Muhammad Ali after a bad fight. Her eye is swollen shut, completely ruptured, bloodied. There are bruises all over her feet. Sarah asks Sean what happened. Sean says that Carly was jumping off the bed, the bunk bed, and hurt herself. Sarah does not call for help. She has Carly call her dad, and David didn't answer the phone, and Carly leaves a message and tells him that she doesn't feel good, that she misses him. Sarah calls her own father and says, Carly seems to have an eye allergy. There's no way in hell that looked like an eye allergy. The eye is ruptured. Even if Carly had lived, she would have been blind in that eye, the doctor testified to in court.
Incredible.
And Sarah leaves her again. She does not take her to the hospital. She does not call a friend. She does not seek medical help for her daughter. She, in fact, puts Carly in front of the TV with a handful of granola for breakfast, and she goes and has sex with Sean Field.
Sure.
And then she leaves her daughter again to go work another shift at the pizza place. When she comes home, Carly's dead on the floor in the other room. Or she comes home and there's a time lapse. And in that time lapse, Carly dies. That's never really made clear.
So there's finally a call to emergency services, and what do they find? Again, you had the unfortunate, you took a look at this photo, unfortunately, what do you talk about the fire responder and the police that come there? What do they see? What's obvious to them? What has happened?
So Sarah makes the 911 calls. She's beyond hysterical. I've heard lots of 911 calls. This particular 911 call is different in its sheer intensity. And she's screaming that her daughter isn't breathing. Her daughter isn't breathing. According to Sarah's testimony in court, she comes home. She asked Sean where Carly is, and he said she was laying down in the other room and not, you know, doing well. Sarah goes in there, and Carly isn't breathing. And so during this 911 call, they're telling her how to do CPR. Nobody ever did CPR on Carly, not until the EMTs arrive. When the EMTs arrive, they know Sarah. Because she is a party girl in town, and she's beautiful. They've all had, some of them have had relations with her. And so they know her, and they make excuses for her right off the bat, not looking at her as a potential person involved in the murder of a child, but, hey, that's our friend Sarah. And Sean Fields' response is he's concerned. He's taken all these chairs and the table, and he's pushed them up against this closet door, not concerned about Carly, not the fact that he has a dead child on the floor in his home,
no,
but concerned because he has a marijuana grow in the closet. And he's worried that if the police come across the marijuana grow, he's going to be arrested. Not worried that he has a dead child on the floor that needs to be accounted for. And so the EMTs get the baby to the hospital. David gets a phone call. He's at work in Portland. He gets a phone call, you know, saying something's happened to Carly. He needs to get to Corvallis right away. It's an hour and a half drive. He leaves work and heads back, and he's calling the hospital to find out what happened, and the doctor tells him in a very ugly manner that Carly is dead. That's how he learns out that his daughter is dead. It's through a doctor who's angry, but he's angry because Sarah has told the doctor and the staff that David did this.
You talk about after, I mean, we don't have enough time to go into probably a next part of this conversation. We could probably talk for another an hour and a half about this. The investigation finally does clear David. It becomes obvious to them that David had nothing to do with this. There is a 26-day trial. We can't go into all the heartbreaking stuff like the photo on the postmortem table that was used when Sarah was on the stand, and dramatic testimony, well, not dramatic, but it's heartbreaking again for a 10-year-old Sean Fields' daughter who lived in the home with them and knew Carly was forced to testify. So we don't have all that time to go into all of those things. Suffice to say that he was finally incarcerated, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, all the while insisting that he did not do this. The tapes are clear. He maintains his innocence. He had nothing to do with this at all. And it isn't until after hours and hours of interrogation that he finally says, well, maybe Sarah did that. Maybe Sarah did it.
Yeah.
And so what the cops who dealt with this in the aftermath felt like, you know, you had two very narcissistic people. And there's an excellent book. I recommend it to anyone, especially in today's world, to read, called The Narcissism Epidemic, which I did read during the investigation here, but this investigation, they just, Sarah and Sean had a chemistry that was an uncommon chemistry and inexplicable in many ways. And it was like two cons trying to out-con each other, was how one of the cops put it to me. Two cons trying to out-con each other, and what they're bartering with is a little three-year-old girl in the process. And what the Carly story reveals to us is that we have big misconceptions about how child abuse happens in our society. I had been so focused on war and its aftermath for so long because of my own childhood experiences that it never, you know, during that time period, during that 10-year time period that we'd been at war in Iraq and Afghanistan, we had lost somewhere around 6,800 soldiers, mothers and fathers.
Right.
But if you went and lined up all of the kids who died of child abuse during that same 10-year time period and laid them out in quilt-covered caskets instead of flag-draped ones, here on U.S. soil, we would have seen 20,000 caskets. We lose 1,500 children a year to child abuse in this nation. 1,500 that we know about. We lose 5 children a day. If Disneyland had a ride that lost 5 children a day, we would shut Disneyland down the first day.
Yeah.
But here in this country, children are living in fear daily. These are just the children who die. I get letters weekly from people who live through this kind of horror. Thankfully, they live, but they don't come away unscathed. I think of post-traumatic stress disorder as something that soldiers live with, but in truth, children who've been abused live with it every single day, and there are more of them than there are soldiers who are dealing with it. That's how prevalent child abuse is. And the wealthier you are, the more educated you are, the higher you are up in society, the less likely your child is going to be believed when they do report the abuse, if they ever get around to it.
I want to congratulate you on this book, Carly Sheehan, True Crime of Carly's Law. You really do talk about the pervasiveness of Sarah and the con, and it continues later in your book as well, when we talk about Carly's angels and her raising money, conning people again for charity, pretending she's a single mom. I want to thank you very much, Karen Spears Zacharias. Is there a Facebook page or a website that people might go to take a look at further work or about this book?
Yeah, I mean, they can go to my website at KarenZach.com, just KarenZach.com. You know, kudos to every child out there who has survived this and lived to tell. I mean, the work that they do in our society to raise good families and to be loving people, to heal their own hurts. It's amazing and overwhelming at times to think about it. And, you know, I just encourage everyone to be more alert, to pay better attention, to think about their own biases, and to realize that moms are not always what we think they are. And, you know, just because a woman is beautiful does not make her good-hearted. It does not. That's not to put anyone down for being that. But in Sarah's case, her beauty was the thing that made her stumble.
I want to thank you very much, Karen Spears, Zacharias, for Carly Sheehan. Truly an incredible book. Thank you for this interview. You have a great evening.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you for reading it.
Thank you. And for those two, join me on Facebook for comments on my personal page. Thank you. Good night.